Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is January 9th, 2023. And I'm the host, Mark Ames, here in snowless Rochester, New York, formerly known as the snowiest city in America, apparently. Not even a dusting of snow here. And I'm on the line with the Warnerd, Gary Betcher, a.k.a. John Dolan, in Trieste, Italy. John, how you doing? How was your new year?
It was, you know, nice. But right now we're hosting Jenny Brown and Michael Pollack, friends of the show and prominent Radio Warnerd citizens. And they're as enthusiastic about Trieste as we are, and which is why it's kind of sad right now because we're going to have to leave in a week or so.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a bummer. Do you know where you're going next?
Tunisia for a little while. And then maybe we'll go to the UK because it's out of the EU. We have to get out of the EU. Our official 6-month visas never showed, but our time is up and we got to get out.
Right. I guess now would be not the worst time because, you know, because the dollar, I think, is like, in one of its rare, stronger moments right now.
It is.
And so the UK might not be totally prohibitive at the moment.
No, and we don't want to go to London this time. We want to go somewhere more interesting and somewhere with an indoor pool because my knee has been kind of a mess. And I'd like to swim. So, you know, find a cheap hotel near Glasgow or something.
Right. Oh, so you might go up to Scotland.
Yeah, I've never been to Scotland. Yeah. That'd be good.
Could be chilly up there.
Well, I don't think so. It hasn't even been chilly in Trieste. And
that's true.
It used to be famous for its winters. I mean, it's kind of sad. The world is, the world that I knew is dying, just physically dying. And no doubt there will be other worlds. But you get kind of attached to the world that you thought was eternal.
Yeah. Well, anyway, on a happier note, let's get to our guest. We do have a great guest and a great talk today with Jack Murphy, previous Radio Warnerd guest, to talk about this absolute bombshell of an article that we'll get into about CIA running some funny stuff in our nuclear-powered rival Russia.
It's an amazing article, and maybe the most astonishing thing about it is that so few other news sources have picked up on it.
Yeah. They're shying away from it, as they say.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about all of that. So let's get right to our talk with Jack Murphy. Okay, we're really excited and honored to have back with us Jack Murphy. Jack was a guest eons ago, Radio Warnerd episode 61 on Syria jihadis and chicken hawks. That was back in 2016, which seems like freaking eons ago now. I know.
Yeah.
Anyway, Jack is a special forces vet and journalist and author of numerous books, including his memoir, Murphy's Law, fiction books, nonfiction books. I mean, you know, it makes me feel bad about myself if I name all the books, so I'm just not going to name. But anyway, we'll post a lot of links up here. He's also the author of a lot of really great investigative journalism pieces. I mean, I remember seeing on Yahoo News, the CIA, I mean, I'll just read the headline, the CIA sent a team of four operators on a spy mission targeting China and none came back. That was a pretty big deal. And other big pieces for Yahoo News. And Jack is the author of a real bombshell story that just came out. We'll talk about also the story about the story, but the headline that he has here is the CIA is using a European NATO ally spy service to conduct a covert sabotage campaign inside Russia under the agency's direction. I guess this is the lead, which the CIA is using. Anyway, about the CIA running a European NATO ally spy service to run sabotage ops inside of Russia to disrupt Russia's war in Ukraine. So first of all, just welcome back to the show, and thanks for coming. Thanks for coming on, Jack.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
You were just saying just before we started rolling that there's a big story going down right now at Fort Bragg. And I saw a little bit of Seth Harp, who was also on the show earlier last year, talking about this. But you actually have a piece coming out, which should be out certainly by the time we post the show. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Yeah. Yes. Seth's actually writing a book about this stuff. And I mean, he's going to have plenty to write about. I mean, I'm glad he's working on it because that's a full-time job in of itself.
Right.
But so, yeah, I mean, it's difficult to know like where this story begins, and certainly we don't know where it ends. But long story short, last week, a special forces member down at Fort Bragg was picked up. He moonlights as a bouncer at a special forces bar in Southern Pines, North Carolina. And as I've been told, he was also pimping underage girls. A lot of these girls, you'd say they're like 19, they're really like 15. Mm. And he was also with another guy, a guy who was heavy into drug trafficking. Both of these dudes were in 1st Battalion, 3rd Special Forces Group. And they, basically I've been hearing stories about these drug-fueled sex parties around Southern Pines with a lot of Special Forces guys. And, you know, at these parties, it's, you know, who knows who walks through the door. I've heard that there are some, fairly high-ranking people who have been involved at various times. So they picked those two guys up over the week. It's unclear if they sang like songbirds or if they just ripped the cell phones or maybe both. But mm-hmm. what that led to was them questioning a whole bunch of people across various special operations commands on Fort Bragg. Guys in Special Operations, Army Special Operations Command in the Special Warfare Training Group at 3rd Special Forces Group in Delta Force. And they did like a dragnet at the gates, and they stopped these guys as they came through, started questioning them. I'm told they even questioned the 3rd Group physician's assistant because some of the drugs going around are like fentanyl and fentanyl lollipops, like controlled substances that probably came out of the medic cabinet on at the unit. So they questioned all those guys. And meanwhile, I mean, there's all kinds of just rumors and fear and panic ripping through the special forces community over the weekend. Guys are flushing their drug stash down the toilet.
Shit.
Dudes are all rushing to hide their nefarious activities. There's rumors that this is going to get tied to a number of murders and suspicious deaths around the Fort Bragg area over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, is it related to that? Because it seems like Special Forces had a kind of something like immunity for a while, and then so many scandals started popping up around Fort Bragg that wasn't.
Yeah, there's definitely, Billy Levine killed his best friend, Mark Leshikar. Billy was in Delta at the time. Leshikar was in SF. And then Levine and Dumas are found dead on a training site at Fort Bragg. I had a law enforcement source confirm to me that Dumas was in fact connected to international drug trafficking. That he was partnered up with a former police officer, and they were smuggling drugs from Mexico to the United States. And there's a whole interesting story there about how the cop, he got fired over some bullshit. It was kind of petty stuff he got fired for. And he started a legitimate import-export business running washer dryers down to Mexico. And then like any entrepreneur starts thinking, well, I'm making the trip down here, but then I'm coming home empty.
Right.
And so because he was a cop, and I believe he was a canine cop also, like he knew the procedures very well. He had a whole like almost religious ritual he went through where he'd wipe down the satchels of cocaine with ammonia. And then when he drove across the border, he'd have like open containers of ammonia in his vehicle to throw off the drug dogs.
And he could try it on his own dog, like, Brandy, you smell anything?
Yeah. And, I guess coffee doesn't work.
So. And it all started coming out because him and Dumas, did they pretended to be police officers and they raided a rival's trap house down in that North Carolina Fayetteville area, went in and federal agents, hands in the air, bitches. And the old lady in the old woman in the house had a heart attack. They cut the flex cuffs off and they legitimately were like, we're not here to actually hurt anyone. And they let the family call EMS. And the EMS, the ambulance arrived as those two jabronis were peeling off target. And the EMTs run into these two guys pretending to be cops and they have a brief conversation. And then the two guys take off and the EMS is like, something doesn't feel right about those dudes. Yeah. And sure enough, the police
scene.
And the police figure out that these guys were posers. And then the next thing, Dumas and Billy both had pending court dates. But then, they both turn up dead. And the former police officer, he's in prison on the drug charges. Who obviously there's still a murderer on the loose. Somebody killed Dumas and Billy, and we don't know who, but FBI got involved in that investigation, which one could speculate that would imply that there is either definitely across state lines, but perhaps an international connection to the case. So I only bring all of that up because I think the notion that a pimp and a drug dealer were arrested last week, and that led to them, this massive bust over the weekend. Kind of defies the bureaucracy simply does not move that quickly. I think there's probably a much larger investigation, and then on Sunday they did a 100% recall of 1st Battalion, 3rd Special Forces Group, where this stuff is all centered around, and had everyone show up in uniform, and they piss tested the entire battalion.
Wow.
So all kinds of guys are going to piss hot because of that. And this scandal is expected to kind of spread outwards, sprawl outwards to the other battalions, as the week goes on.
That's crazy, man. How does that get so out of control? Is it because they're given a lot of leeway and expected to be sort of renegades in a sense? Or how does that get that out of control?
Man, there's a lot that goes into that. I mean, there's a lot of cultural things and also lack of accountability. With the command, I'll just say, for example, when I was in Ranger Battalion, we got piss tested all the time, sometimes multiple times in 1 week. They would do a piss test, and then there's those, supposedly those people are going to go smoke a joint the next day, figuring we won't get it again for a month.
Right.
So they'll just piss test you the next day. Gotcha. They piss tested us religiously. When I got to Special Forces, I was never piss tested once. I don't recall a single piss test that we did while we were there over the course of however long I was there. They don't want to know. It's a classic case with this and so many other things. No data, no problem, right?
Right. Okay. And they want guys to be not totally necessarily straight-laced in the mindset anyway. Am I right? Does that have something to do with it?
It's a strange culture because Special Forces is an unconventional warfare unit.
Exactly.
You're expected to bend the rules, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you have to grow a beard while you're overseas, or maybe the partner force you're with is like, hey, we're gonna take a shot of vodka because we're celebrating, that's strictly against Army, UCMJ. But as an SF guy, you're expected to hey, we operate in a gray environment. We're going to break the rules sometimes, But it's a question of knowing what rules to break. We're going to break the facial hair rules. We're not going to break the war crimes rules, right? There's a scale of what's sort of acceptable behavior. And, if you end up in a unit with a certain culture, with a certain leadership, with leaders that want to turn a blind eye to things, it gets worse and worse and worse. And, so I think this is something that's been percolating really for decades. I mean, this stuff has always been in Special Forces, but I think you have certain clusters where it's allowed to fester and it just gets worse and worse until it boils over like this.
So Seth Harp's going to have a lot, as you said,
to write about. He's going to be busy. He's going to be busy.
Okay, so we'll also look for your, where's your piece coming out?
It should be on Connecting Vets, and I mean, actually, okay. it should be published today.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, well, then we'll be able to link to it.
Connecting Vets.
Yeah.
All right.
But let's get to your big bombshell, or the reason that we sure. wrote to you. We posted this on the Radio Warnerd Facebook page, and, you know, had some, like a lot of discussion about it, and one thing I noticed, though, and first of all, there's a lot we want to talk about here. The story itself, first of all, and then also the story about getting the story out. Mm-hmm. But it's a big story, and it has not gotten around. I mean, I was looking for some, and maybe I'm wrong, I was looking for other reactions from other maybe blue check types who are covering sort of that area and the war and so on. The only one I really saw who had something to say about it was the Economist defense correspondent. What's his name?
Shashank Joshi.
Yeah, who was kind of like, you know, cautious about, you know, saying, this is interesting. I'm not sure, maybe. But then when people, other blue checks kind of moved into his mentions and tried to shoot it down, he defended it. So it wasn't like he shot it down. But so I guess, first of all, why don't we talk about the story? Can you just describe the story, first of all?
Long story short is that a NATO ally had been operating cells within Russia for a long period of time, probably going back 10 to 15 years. And after the 2014 invasion of Ukraine, the United States partnered with that country's intelligence service and essentially turned up the dial. They ratcheted it up and began contributing to that effort. And the first teams, the first sleeper cells that were sponsored by the United States, by the Central Intelligence Agency, you know, that had that was overseeing it, they went into Russia in 2016. Mm-hmm. And since that time, this Allied Intelligence Service and that unit's or that that country's counterterrorism service has trained these cells. These are civilian groups. Absolutely, they are non-American. No American citizens involved. Running them through mission rehearsals, and then they have been inserting into Russia. Sometimes smuggling in the equipment they need. Sometimes they are working out of cache site locations that have been in the ground for 10 to 15 years. And the cells were laid dormant until Russia's invasion of Ukraine back in February. And 2 days before the invasion, the cells were activated. They went and they dug up the equipment out of the cache locations and prepared, and they stood by. They had, you know, done target reconnaissance. They knew what they were doing, and they were ready to go. And they began receiving the green light to begin striking targets. And this is what you've seen pretty much since day one of the invasion. It began, where you saw rail lines being hit, you saw fuel depots being hit, ammo depots being hit. And then as the war went on, you started to see warehouses, power stations, things like this burning to the ground. There is a building belonging to the Russian Aerospace Ministry or something like this that also burned down pretty early on in the conflict. And so a lot of these mysterious fires that you're seeing in Russia are, they are what you think they are, that there is an intelligence behind them. When you look at them and it looks like, hey, there is a target engagement criteria being used to engage these targets. It's happening so quickly. It's like they were pre-selected, like there is a target reconnaissance that was done ahead of time. Mm. Well, there was, and that's what you're seeing at play.
I guess one question we kind of had was, are there other examples you can think of where the CIA kind of managed or took sort of overall responsibility or top-level responsibility for an ally's operation in a third country, a hostile or targeted country? Has this happened much before? I mean, I feel like we've done this with Israel in some third place before, but maybe Israel wouldn't subordinate themselves to the CIA in that. I'm not sure.
this is, I think, in Russia is pretty unprecedented. But right. this type of operation is hardly anything new. Okay. This is something that U.S. Special Forces has been, you know, doing to various extents since the 1950s. The CIA has been working on stuff like this for the last 75 years. You know, we work by, with, and through partner forces. And that's what you're seeing here, working through a partner force to put yet another force into a third country. Okay. We've done this in, there were sabotage operations launched from South Vietnam into North Vietnam with American right. signals intelligence supporting it. It's a very, very similar template as to what we've seen in Russia. We did sabotage operations in Nicaragua in the 1980s. Mentioned in the article is in 2003, we being, you know, America, the CIA sent paramilitary guys into North Iraq and trained up right. Kurds, a bunch of Kurdish cells as saboteurs. And they went behind enemy lines into Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and they sabotaged a rail line and turned a 90-car train on its side. They blew up the office of an Iraqi intelligence official. So they were out there behind enemy lines, just kind of wreaking havoc. They were also launching, you know, propaganda operations, inserting like radio transmitters that would override local radio stations and transmit coalition propaganda. So this sort of thing is hardly unprecedented.
The use of a second government's intelligence agencies as a kind of shell company, let's say.
Right, to subvert the third country.
That seems like something that you would do only in this case because, among other reasons, those other countries didn't have a large and ready nuclear arsenal. So you have to be a little more careful.
Yeah, well, I mean, as my sources described to me, I mean, this was part of President Biden's condition on greenlighting this at all is that it had to go through a third country, that, you know, the CIA could not be directly involved, like directly have their hands on these cells and be putting them into Russia. Our relationship with this country, I mean, it's very much a partnership. We have run intelligence operations with them in the past to the point that we will train their operatives and they will run the operation for us. You know, in a manner that's mutually beneficial. I mean, it's a relationship that goes back many decades.
Yeah, you made a point of saying they're not a proxy, as in they choose what they're going to go in on.
Right.
It's a longstanding partnership that goes back a long ways. And, you know, when we look at Russia and, you know, a lot of people say like it's or some people would express skepticism, which I understand. Is, you know, the agency could never do this. They couldn't do this because of this reason and that reason and the capability and capacity, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, yes, Russia is denied territory to the United States. The CIA's personnel working out of the embassy in Moscow are under heavy, heavy surveillance. I mean, they're under harassing surveillance all the time.
Right.
However, who is Russia denied to? It's denied to America. Is it denied to our liaison? The various partners that we liaison with, and they may be in a very different situation.
Can you talk about what sort of, assistance the CIA gives? Is it in planning? Is it in training? Is it in intelligence? Is it equipment?
They're not, again, not directly hands-on doing the training, but they're doing the overseeing and the managing, the oversight, target selection, intelligence distribution, and then the United States also with our capabilities and like signals intelligence are providing that sort of like reach back element.
Yeah, you mentioned that this has been using cells that had been set up 15 years ago, which would put it before the Crimea annexation. So some agencies have clearly been working on setting up sleeper cells inside Russia for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, there are other countries in Europe that have national security interests and good reasons to be wary of Russia based on history. And, my article is really concerning a particular country that the agency that the CIA has partnered with to run these operations. But there are other players in the game. There are a number of other operations that activated their, what I came to find out longstanding Cold War era resistance networks that they activated when Russia invaded Ukraine. And those networks play a part also in running surrogates into Russia.
And those have a pretty dicey history. I mean, there's the obvious Gladiator. We did a, I don't know, three-part series a while back on Gladio. Although our Italian guest on that would say that Gladio was not the real part of the story. It was really the Italian. It was all pretty much like mostly an intra-Italian thing. But
yeah, but I think that is probably right. And you know, I have certainly read whatever is publicly available out there. You know, Gladio being the term we've given to the Italian stay-behind networks during the Cold War. I know there's certainly conspiracy theories out there about that the CIA killed Aldo Moro and all these sorts of things. And I mean, I'm open to the evidence if it exists, but I haven't seen any.
Well, I think the idea is that Gladio and other stay-behind networks, as they became sort of frozen because they weren't needed in the, you know, the Soviet Union didn't invade in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And so, but those, the networks that were set up and the kind of off-books money and weapons, and then the networks within the intelligence, you know, like units within intelligence agencies, like created opportunities for, you know, actors to turn that to political ends, like domestic political ends. And that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's probably how that happened.
Right.
And that may or may not play into some of the things I've been told about these networks, that under existing laws, the CIA cannot work through a proxy force and just sort of wash their hands clean of it, you know, based right. on like a lot of that stuff that happened in Central America. We can't just say, oh, well, the Contras are, you know, they went right. rogue and they did their own yeah. thing and they wiped out this village. You know, it's not our fault.
Right.
That there are some legal stipulations that mean the CIA has to have some command and control over these elements. They can't just leave it to a third party and wash their hands of it.
Really? Yeah. That's interesting, because they do that, or at least did that all the time. I don't know, maybe they don't anymore, but aren't they kind of famous for doing stuff like that, or no?
It certainly has happened in the past, yeah. and I think there's some caution about it.
I see.
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned the difference between CIA paramilitary and the kind yeah. of armed forces, special forces that you were discussing in Fort Bragg. Is there a rivalry or a tension between those groups?
U.S. Special Forces, you know, as being active duty military component, really isn't a part of the article that I wrote, although mm-hmm. JSOC does play a supporting role. But is there a tension there between CIA and Special Forces? So there's actually, you know, back to the agency's inception, there is a nexus where Special Operations overlaps with CIA. And, you know, maybe the best example to encompass this is the Omega teams that were active in Afghanistan and Iraq, mm-hmm. In which you had active duty Rangers and SEAL Team 6 operators, in a sense, seconded to the CIA and working mm-hmm. under Title 50 authorities in those countries. So it kind of fuses the capabilities, the direct action strike capabilities of the military with the intelligence gathering abilities of the CIA, which in a sense, I mean, you can look back at Mac V. Sog in Vietnam as almost being like the prototype of this sort of the template for this formula that has been repeated many times. So
what's Mac V. Sog?
Military Assistance Command Vietnam Studies and Observations Group. These were the teams that would go behind the lines in Laos and Cambodia and North Vietnam during the war.
Okay.
And, you know, it's these relationships continue. You know, Special Forces has worked, you know, with, you know, agency programs through the X shops in their units, you know, J3X or J2X or whatever they're calling it now in these Special Forces units. And guys will be either seconded to the agency for certain programs or directly, you know, an ODA will work a tasking. But at the same time, on some level, I would say it's more on like a gentlemanly level. There are policy debates of like, where should covert action authorities reside? Should it reside with CIA or should it reside with Special Forces? And, you know, that debate goes back and forth. I think you could probably make some valid arguments back and forth, right? You know, JSOC has this sort of unprecedented manhunting, you know, quick or no notice hunter killer capability that they can launch anywhere in the world on very short notice and conduct a hostage rescue or a raid against a terrorist organization or any number of, you know, they even have like a counter proliferation capability. They can be tasked to do all sorts of different things. Now, if you went to the CIA Special Activities Division or now the Special Activities Center and said, hey, can you quickly deploy, you know, 30 ground branch guys to go do this secret mission in this part of the world? The agency doesn't necessarily have that kind of capability. But they do have, you know, what they, I think they do better at is, you know, whereas the U.S. military wants to deploy like 150 operators for a job that takes three guys. And they bring in like all these like trucks and deploy half of the Air Force and all of this stuff. The CIA, they have more of a culture that is accepting of like, hey, we're just going to deploy like two guys. And they're just going to go into this area and they're going to be low key and they're going to assess the situation and, you know, come back and write up some reports. And, you know, we'll take a sort of like deliberate small scale action that doesn't involve, you know, like 2/3 of the black budget to get it done.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent.
I got to ask a sort of dumb guy questions because so when you say when the military wants to do some kind of special operation and then they would overdo it or something, the CIA would go light. But you were also sort of contrasting somewhat JSOC with CIA, and maybe you just meant sort of in terms of what they're how quickly they can authorize or how secret they can be. But is when you say the military, you don't mean JSOC. You're talking something, a separate thing, or no?
I guess I'm talking about the military, you know, special operations community, and then we could drill deeper into like JSOC and then special forces, which is not, you know, necessarily JSOC unless it's a certain, they're part of a task force. And I don't know how deep you want to get into the weeds on that, but you know, CIA can move very quickly. And Congress has quite a bit of authority to release funds to them. And you know, the chain of command is also on a very short fuse. I mean, from the president to the director of the CIA, down to, you know, maybe the director of the Special Activities Center. So it can go pretty quickly. But what I'm saying is that the CIA doesn't have that sort of like strike capability that the military has. That the military has this really amazing ability to, you know, they have like, I think they call it the bullet package, where we can deploy, you know, Delta Force operators, a full complement of helicopters from the 160th. We can deploy Rangers as needed and just shoot them out literally anywhere in the world in, you know, hours. And they can be prepared to conduct a whole myriad of special operations missions. And the CIA just, they could not do that on their own.
Right. I guess one thing that seems different this time is that I remember when we talked to you about Syria, there's, maybe I'm getting this wrong, so tell me, but there seemed to be a really deep disagreement about policy where the CIA was going more for the, I don't care if they're jihadis, just give them whatever they want. We're trying to bring down Assad. And the special forces who were tasked with this said, no, we don't like these guys. We don't want to. And it seems like this, at the moment in Ukraine, there's more general consensus.
Right.
I agree with that. And, you know, I'm actually writing more about Syria. Me and Sean Naylor are working on various stories and kind of revisiting some of these topics because there's a lot that hasn't been covered yet. But yeah, I agree with that. There was a lot of tension in the Obama administration itself and a lot of tension between the Department of Defense and the Obama administration that Obama and President Obama himself had no reluctance about using lethal force on America's enemies, but he had advisors around him who were much more cautious and wanted to keep the military on a tight leash. And it wasn't until ISIS blew across the border and took over Mosul and then damn near overran Erbil that suddenly they started taking ISIS seriously. And that also opened up the door for us to hit other targets like the Khorasan group, which, you know, they were an Al-Qaeda organization that was plotting external operations, looking at aviation. I mean, all the triggers that would freak out the CIA and, and the intelligence community, like red alert. So that's ultimately, it took catastrophe to get the administration to take action. And then by the time they did, it was really too late. I mean, there were really no effective moderate rebels left in Syria. They had all been consumed by jihadist organizations. And that left precious little for the CIA and special forces to work with when it came to finding a viable partner force. So I think contrasting this with Ukraine is especially important. Because in Ukraine, as you mentioned, it's like we were finally, not just us, but NATO and our allies. I mean, we're all fighting in one direction for the first time in a really long time. And there does seem to be a general consensus that we found a viable partner force with the Ukrainians. These guys aren't like the Iraqis where we had to provide them, you know, constant 24-hour airstrikes to get them to move 100 meters forward in the fight against ISIS. You know, the Ukrainians certainly need our support, but like these guys are, I mean, they're pretty wild. I mean, they're willing to fight, and they're willing to fight for their country. You know, again, another compare and contrast is Ghani disappearing from Afghanistan in the dead of night. You know, like a week or two after he said, I will stay here and fight and die for my country, and then he packs his suitcases and disappears in the middle of the night. You know, by comparison, Zelensky, you know, he admirably decided to go down with a ship. And you know, there's a whole we're covering like some really broad stuff, and there are many stories within that haven't been written yet. I mean, we did a lot of things to make sure Zelensky stayed safe. We sent in advisors to advise the Ukrainians on unconventional warfare. There's a lot of stuff that took place, you know, in those opening weeks of the war in Ukraine itself. And again, that's like completely aside from the article I wrote. I mean, these are other stories.
Seth Harper told us he had information that, that early on, before people were talking about it, I guess that JSOC was operating inside of Ukraine. And he got like swarmed on Twitter, and you know, you have to like know that you don't respond on Twitter to anything. But I think he was kind of like a little rattled by it, and then he was really annoyed that he let himself get rattled by it. But he did get that.
He's right. There's a CIA station in Ukraine. When Russia invaded, we evacuated everybody. Like there was legitimate thoughts that the country would collapse, and when that didn't happen, everyone came back in. Like maybe 48 hours later, we sent guys back in. And that station has a cap on it. There's only like, I don't know exactly what the number is. It's probably like 200, 300 people that are allowed, you know, just like you heard about, you know, in Syria, we had a cap and it started at like 100 and then it went up to 500 and then it went up to like 1500 and et cetera, et cetera. There's something like that going on in Ukraine. And JSOC guys will filter in. They will train the Ukrainians to do this or that, and then they will leave the station and be backfilled by somebody else working a different mission. I've heard stories about like JSOC guys going in there and training the Ukrainians to use non-attributable radio jamming equipment that they're deploying against Russian forces, things like this.
I want to get back to your article again, but sure. I just got to ask, since we're still on this, and I mean, it's, you know, it's great to talk about even just the war with you and what you know. But our intelligence really thought, not that I knew at all, because I didn't even think Russia was going to invade until the last minute, but our intelligence really thought that Russia was going to fight or invade much more effectively and actually sweep through and take Kyiv. And more, that wasn't just, I mean, they genuinely believed that at first. Is that right? I mean, it's what they say anyway, but.
I mean, there was definitely thought that the country was going to go down. And I, again, there volumes will be written about this, I suppose, in retrospect. But I think they did believe that the country was going to collapse. And I, I mean, this is going to be a really interesting assessment, and I'll be as fascinated as anyone to read about it. Like, did the Ukrainians overperform beyond what we thought they could, or did the Russians underperform way below what we thought they were capable of? Or maybe both of those things happen at the same time.
Yeah. Especially the underperforming Russians. Like, okay, I should just confess, I'm an old guy. I grew up during the Cold War. And my impression was that infiltrating the USSR was pretty much impossible for the CIA and other Western forces. Maybe the British did a little better sometimes, but they also were more penetrated themselves. But now you have this amazing passage that I want to quote. The overlapping nature, this is from Jack's article, the overlapping nature of the various covert action campaigns behind Russian lines has created problems for the Western spy services running these missions. Over the summer, it became clear to CIA officers that there was increasingly a need for deconfliction among their own surrogate forces in Russia, according to two former military officials. Numerous incidents took place in which rail lines or power lines were cut that unintentionally interfered with other missions, one of them said.
That's insane. That's like Life of Brian when the two groups run into each other under the palace. Like, there's that many,
sabotage teams working in Russia?
They're like stumbling over each other?
Yeah, so I mean, also understand, like, there are different countries running different cells in there. And but they're probably all operating on a somewhat standard target engagement criteria, and the targets they can hit are limited by, you know, the targets that they can hit. Like, these teams probably don't have the capability or the capacity to hit like, let's say, military bases. Like, if they could hit a military target, that's exactly what they would do. That would be the highest priority targets. Is military, but those targets are difficult because of the security around those types of installations. I've been told, like, another thing they were targeting was bridges, but the bridges increasingly became under guard as well. So you start to look then for softer targets. You know, like, I don't think I wrote about this in the article, but because the bridges were being watched, they started looking at actually destroying roads, and they were looking at smuggling cratering charges into Russia and destroying the roads. And that's just an example of how, like, you're having to, you know, like a gorilla, you know, swims amongst the population, like a fish in the water, blah, blah, a leaf in the wind, all that nonsense, right? That they're looking for softer targets. And in at least one instance, the two cells ended up stepping on one another. They were you know, casing the same target, and it led to them compromising one another. And in other cases, I was told that, that cells, they blew up stuff that ended up interfering with other covert operations. There is some, you know, method to the madness, even though the cells are operating in, like, a very decentralized manner, in that the strikes carry, you know, you could argue that these are all tactical targets, that they're not really strategic targets, and that they're more like harassing strikes.
It's like psychological effects, basically, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That they carry a psychological component to say, hey, look, we're here. And it's quite intentional that we, you know, whether it's a NATO partner or the United States intelligence community, have an established a front group, right? Like, for propaganda purposes, you might establish, like, some sort of make-believe terrorist organization. Like, we're the, you know, Russia Rising or the Russia Front group or whatever.
Or the anarcho-communists.
You
know, sorry.
Yeah. You do some Jihad John videos where you're wearing a balaclava and brandishing a knife, and you say, Russia, you have 36 hours to vacate Ukraine, you know, that kind of thing. It's intentional that they have not done that, and that no group has claimed credit, because they're trying to send the security services just scrambling to find these people. And by them doing that, it bogs them down, it keeps them busy, and it spreads them thin, which opens up the door potentially for other operations.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I mean, almost payment for James Jesus Angleton and his his mole tracking that almost destroyed the CIA itself.
You know, right. I don't think you're wrong, though, when you say that the ability for, like, you know, a CIA officer to go undercover in Russia and, like, blend in and disappear and establish networks is, like, basically impossible. I mean, I don't think that's wrong. You've seen, I mean, even during the Cold War, and I think it's true today, the action as far as recruiting Russians is not in Moscow. It's not in Russia. It's never been in Russia. Mm. I mean, even Berlin was, like, too hot. So the action became Africa. And we were, you know, the reason why the CIA was so active in Africa was simply because we were trying to recruit Russians working out of embassies there. You know, there were we were recruiting guys like there's one famous spy. I mean, we recruited a guy out of the Russia station in Bogota. So it becomes this sort of game where, you know, the rest of the world becomes the playground. But Russia itself is denied territory for us.
One of the obvious questions that comes up from this is, I mean, isn't this dangerous? Like, first of all, I mean, publishing this story, if you know about it, then you have to assume that the FSB, you know, Russian intelligence has already known that So they know, obviously, because there have been explosions rail cars that have gone off.
And they know the difference between, like, an angry teenager throwing a Molotov cocktail into a recruiting station and, you know, a tactical or strategic target being hit with precision.
Right. So it's not like your article is going to precipitate World War III, but
some people would argue that, but no, I think that's pure, you know, science fiction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be, you know, quite a feat if you could launch through your personal website, but yeah. But I guess the question is, though, isn't it dangerous, nevertheless, for the U.S. to have? Pull this back. Russia knows that there's some kind of sleeper cell, you know, sabotage activity going on inside of its territory. Did it know that the CIA was kind of patronizing this?
I've been told that yes, they know who they're being hit by.
Okay.
You're right. It is dangerous. I mean, we're basically staring down the barrel of a gun, like we did during the Cuban Missile Crisis or other points in history. It's a fait accompli. You're saying, yeah, we're doing this. What are you going to do about it?
Exactly.
And, you know, from a from the perspective of, you know, the American government, from the CIA, I mean, the way they look at it, I would think is that, you know, the Russians were fucking around in our backyard, too. That, you know, they tried to assassinate that dude with a novel radioactive substance in the UK.
Right.
That there's been GRU guys screwing around in Europe. That they tried to screw around with our election in 2016. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they probably, you know, I would agree that this is an escalation. But I think it's also very interesting to see, you know, some of the comments I spoke to Michael Kaufman, who's a Russia analyst, when I wrote
he's
the
good.
Article.
Yeah.
And, you know, he points out, he's like, there's this real fear when it comes to competition or conflict between superpowers or great powers, whatever we call them, that we would stumble into war.
Right.
That we would take an action that's misinterpreted,
right.
Or we would step across a red line that we don't necessarily know is there, and that will lead to this larger conflagration, potentially sparking World War III. But what he points out is that this is not really how the apparatus of the state thinks, that they look at these things on a case-by-case basis, and they determine the ROI. And Russia they obviously know these sabotage acts are happening in their country, but they have pretty much chosen to turn a blind eye to it. They've written a lot of it off as, you know, just random occurrences. Mm-hmm. They haven't made a big stink about it. And then when you look at the Nord Stream pipeline.
Yes, I was going to get to that, but yeah.
And, you know, I can't tell you factually. I know what happened there. Mm-hmm. I don't. And publicly, you know, they're saying there really isn't any evidence. And I think my sources don't have any evidence either. But they told me their working theory is that it was the Russians. They certainly said it wasn't us. They're like, we would not touch a target like that at this time. You know, if open war broke out, maybe it would be different. But, you know, needless to say, that happened. And what have we had to say about that? Like, what has our response been? And I would argue that we largely chose to ignore that.
Mm. Right. The Swedes conducted their own investigation. It was apparently very thorough. And then they said, we're not going to be telling anybody what we found out.
Right. Yeah. Well, and they leaked to Politico, or, you know, unnamed European officials leaked to Politico that they don't have any evidence it was the Russians. And it's hard to, how do you interpret that? I mean, because it seems to me whoever did it, this is the weird thing about it. Like, I personally, I regret now even saying, heavily qualifying and saying, if I had to say who did it, and I have no freaking idea and I don't want to predict blah, blah, blah. But it would seem, because there's so many downsides for either side doing it,
right,
that the Russians have already proven that they've done some dumb things, that they might have been a little dumber. Because if it was us or one of our allies, I mean, it's Russian-owned, but it's really German critical energy infrastructure. So it's really an attack on our ally and the start of winter. And it seems crazy.
It happened just as Ukraine was on the offensive. And
right,
retaking
exactly.
Territory.
And just as Putin was doing the new mobilization and putting in Surovikin and like changing everything. So it seemed crazy, but like it seemed crazy for either side kind of to do it, but slightly less crazy for Russia to have done it. But I guess, you know, I guess we'll find out. So you would put your money, if you had to, more on Russia having done it than Poland or the Baltics or whatever?
I would, yes. Yeah. I don't think that the USS Jimmy Carter went in there and destroyed a NATO allies pipeline. Like, I have a really difficult time.
I mean, it would be
time.
Really stupid, right?
It would be very stupid, yes. Yeah. So that's where I would place my money. But I mean, the jury is still out on that. Yeah. I couldn't factually tell you that's how it went down.
Because I got to say, reading your article, I started, you know, first, when Politico came out and the whole weirdness about not attributing it, well, I guess what you're saying is one way of interpreting the not attributing, you know, directly saying, okay, Russia did this and leaving it kind of open, is a way of acknowledging that, okay, Russia kind of struck back at us or did some sabotage that's sort of at us, but sort of not, and we're just not going to acknowledge it either. But another thing I thought reading your piece was, well, that sounds like the kind of thing these guys could do. And does that mean the CIA would have even known? And is that why Radek Sikorsky tweeted out, thank you, Biden, or whatever, you know, with a bubbling sea. I don't know if you saw that.
No, I didn't.
Oh, Sikorsky, who was the big, you know, Ann Applebaum's husband and the big Polish former foreign minister. When the Nord Stream pipeline first blew up, he tweeted out a photo of like the bubbling, you know, from where the explosion was and said, thank you, America, or thank you, Biden, or something like that. And then deleted it after everyone jumped on it. But anyway, so I guess, you know, it's a great mystery. But
again, it's another story that will have to be followed up and written about and researched in years to come.
Right.
I wish I knew. If I had some tea to spill, I'd let you know, but I just don't know.
Right. Let's talk about the publication of the article.
I
think that's one of the most interesting stories here. And it starts, I guess, with this note that, Jack, you put at the end of this article. Mark, do you want to read this?
Yeah, I got to say, this was this note alone was really remarkable and, like, just really made me have a lot of respect to you for this. And also triggered a lot of bad memories of myself and problems I've had every now and then publishing something. But I just want to read from this. It's a great note. Okay, a note on the publication of this article, basically why it was on his website. Many will ask why an article of this importance is appearing on my personal website rather than in a prestigious publication. I will not detail the entire journey this article took at this time, but we'll say that while working with editors at mainstream publications, I was asked to do things that were illegal and unethical in one instance. And in another instance, I felt that a senior CIA official was able to edit my article by making off-the-record statements before he leaked a story to the New York Times to undermine this piece. I don't begrudge the intelligence community for doing their job. That's their job. However, I do blame the press for not fulfilling the most basic premise of their job. And then, you know, you go into some other stuff, some of it, which we've covered here. can you, I mean, you know, so first of all, respect for that, but it must be incredibly frustrating having gone through that. Can you talk a little bit more about that, about the problems you went through?
Yeah, it was. You know, the first outlet I took this story to, they had gone through some editorial changes and they told me like, hey, this is too heavy a lift for us right now. And I think they were being truthful about that. Mm-hmm. The second one I went to, I was working with them and this is a pretty sizable outlet, right? And they said, they asked me, you know, could you get proof? And, you know, there's about I think, six anonymous sources in my story, mm-hmm. and then a few that are maybe four or five that are on the record adding mm-hmm. context. But they asked me if I could get proof. And I said, well, okay, what constitutes proof in your mind? And they're like, well, can you get like one of your sources to like take a picture on their cell phone of like some PowerPoint slides or like get a hold of some documents? Yeah. And, okay, I'm not going to do that because it's illegal and unethical. As a journalist, you can't task sources to steal classified documents. But I decided to be a bit of a smartass, to tell you the truth. And instead of telling them no and asking them why they're dumb, I said, okay, sure, I'll do that. But I need you to put it in writing in a contract with me. I need to know I have legal protection.
Right.
And they're like, okay, sure. And can you just like put into an email, you know, for us, like what you want us to write in the contract? I was like, I'd be happy to. And so I wrote exactly that. I was like, I want a contract where you specify that you want me to task sources to break the law and steal classified documents. And that's man, good. You should have seen how fast they backpedaled.
Wow.
That was the funniest damn thing I'd ever seen. And I told the guy, I was like, look, man, like, I was like, if you had told a younger, dumber journalist to do this, they might have done it.
Totally.
Yeah.
They might have done it. Yes. And then you have, you know, like a reality winner type situation where the government's going to figure out who that person is in two fucking seconds and they're going to jail. You know, maybe the journalist is getting indicted, you know, and what does that do for your news outlet? Right.
Yeah.
So I parted ways with them at that point and went over to another outlet. And spent a long time with them working on this article and reworking it. And it went through a very vigorous fact-checking process. I was promised that it would be a proctology exam, and that was not a lie. but I understand all of that. I mean, they want to do credible journalism, and that's perfectly respectable that you want to make sure your sourcing is together. And then we came up with a publication plan. The plan was that we would go to the CIA for official comment, which you have to do is the right thing to do. And we would give them 48 hours to reply.
Right.
And then 48 hours after that, we were going to publish. Mm-hmm. Okay. Sounds like a plan. Got it. So
48 hours is a lot, actually, if you ask me. I'd do more. But I guess it's the CIA and this is a big story. But
24
is usually what I would do. But
They were trying to give the agency a fair amount of time to reply while also not giving them enough time to start trying to maneuver around us.
Exactly.
Which is what ultimately happened.
Right.
So we go to the agency, have a kind of an odd exchange with their public affairs people. Tell them, we need an on the record statement from you guys. And they give it, which is in the article. It's just a flat denial that there's no truth to this at all, that this whole story is fake.
And as you point out, by law, they are allowed to or required or something to lie about covert activities.
Yeah they have to. I mean,
they only have to tell the Gang of Eight.
That's right.
Yeah. I'll talk a little bit more about that, about the ethics of espionage, I guess. But they're certainly within their rights to deny covert activities.
Right.
And so then the deputy director of the CIA wants to have a call with us. And I told my editor, I said that I can talk anytime today except, you know, this time, like 1:50 or whatever it was, because I have to go pick up my kid from school.
Right.
Any other time I'm free. Okay, so when did that call take place?
Jesus, yeah.
The one time I was not available.
Yeah.
Right.
Probably because the CIA guy figured you, given your background, would be a little less impressed or easily bowled over than an editor. I don't know. I'm just thinking this probably was on his mind.
One can only speculate.
Yeah.
He then had a conversation with David Cohen, the deputy director. Mm-hmm. They had an off-the-record conversation. There was no off-the-record agreement ever reached between me and David Cohen. So what he told my editor was that it's the Ukrainians. They're rogue Ukrainian operations. They're off the rails. They're doing their own thing. It's not us. We have nothing to do with it.
Mm.
All right, this makes no goddamn sense whatsoever.
Right.
For a whole variety of reasons, but I understand why he would say that. It's a great cover story because what are the Russians going to do in retaliation? Yeah,
invade Ukraine?
They're going to invade. We're going to invade you, Kiev.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Okay, I got it. But now the editor's point of view is we need to square the circle to make my story jive with the CIA's off-the-record statements. And he's going in there and he's editing out essentially any reference in my article to the CIA and making it out to look like these are Ukrainian cells that are just doing their own thing.
Wow.
And I'm like, well, why is this guy allowed to make off-the-record statements? You know, maybe it would be somewhat different if he was on the record and we could publish those statements, but off the record, what? My reporting was fact-checked and verified and deemed newsworthy, you know, 15 minutes ago, and now we're off on a totally different track.
You mentioned that he released a story to basically preclude or ruin your story.
That's a classic move, yeah.
Basically, we ended up sitting on our hands trying to square the circle. And in the meantime, like maybe 5 or 6 days after that call happened, a story pops up in the New York Times. And it is a story about this topic, blaming these acts of sabotage on Ukraine and saying there's all this tension between CIA and Ukraine, between America and Ukraine, because they're off the rails doing these unauthorized ops and we just can't get control over them. And interestingly, that article had a lot of information in it about Dugina and the Dugina assassination and basically like trying to distance the United States from that, which again, I found interesting because none of my questions to CIA once mentioned Dugina.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's not your emphasis at all. It's more on classic military sabotage.
Yeah. They went down that road on their own. And much like the Nord Stream pipeline, I mean, I've heard whispers of things about Dugina, but nothing that I would really be comfortable saying as if I know or as if it's a fact. I think there's more to follow on that. But I did find it interesting that, you know, clearly this story was leaked, if you would even call it a leak. It was handed to the New York Times by David Cohen.
What does that say about the New York Times, man?
You can draw your own conclusions from that. That they're laundering these stories for the CIA.
Yeah.
I was just going to read a paragraph from your note at the end of the article that I think is really important because when you try to do a story like this, you get accused of disloyalty or something. Mm. But it's a farce in that way. As you say here, the Russian government knows perfectly well who is sponsoring these sabotage strikes. Moreover, the intelligence community wants them to know. The only party left in the dark is the public at large, left unaware of the shadow war taking place behind the scenes. And that's absolutely true. I mean, if you think about it for a few seconds, you got to realize that. Of course they know. They both know. They just don't want anybody interfering while the proverbial sausage is being made.
They're choosing to turn a blind eye. I mean, both sides are in a sense. It is a game of brinksmanship. And it's been interesting. I mean, there is a really strong, like I think public interest and public response in the article. I think the intelligence community, even the people who are pretty loud and not hesitant to do any shit talking at all, were deafeningly silent on this one. Mm-hmm. The only kind of like pushback I heard was just sort of like, you know, people saying if this was real, you wouldn't know about it. And, you know, since you do know about it, it can't be real. And even if it was real, you shouldn't have reported it. Mm. And it's like, well, okay, this is circular logic. I'll just like leave you to it then. And I don't mind the skepticism. I invite the skepticism. When I first heard about this story, I was shocked. I didn't believe it. I guess I was in sort of a state of disbelief. Because it's ballsy. It's ballsy and it is provocative. And mm-hmm. I didn't think we were there yet. Right. Like maybe if Russia invaded a NATO ally, like we would get there, right?
Right.
I was surprised that we went ugly early. Which could be good or bad, right? It could be construed as good or bad.
Raises an interesting sort of cheap thriller question, like, does Russia have sleeper cells?
And I think that's an interesting conversation too, because I mean, we heard the same thing about like Iran and Hezbollah, and like, oh, we can't mess with Iran because like these Hezbollah sleeper cells will wreak havoc across America. And I mean, we smoke checked Soleimani in Baghdad and nothing happened, right?
I admit I did believe in Hezbollah's capacity for chaos much more than I did.
They do have a history of effective terrorist plotting, and you know, maybe part of the reason why it hasn't happened is because Soleimani was such a singular and effective member of that of Quds Force and that organization that without him it became more difficult for them to run ops, which is another conversation. Mm. But
interesting.
I mean, if Russia had sleeper cells, I mean, you'd think they would activate them, right? We know they did have some sleepers here during the Cold War. And, you know, after the wall came down, we found out who a lot of them were. Mm. And, you know, Milt Bearden's book talks about, you know, like confronting, you know, like some like guy, some Czech guy living in the middle of America. And like, he's a soccer dad now. And he's like, he's like, okay, well, you know, you got me. Like, can I stay here though? Now that I'm here?
Oh, come on, my knees. I mean, you want me to kneel down on a railroad track and put a charge in there? No.
I mean, there's also Anna Chapman. I mean, there were those, was that unofficials. Sleeper cell group.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, what is going on here? Has our counterintelligence gotten so effective all of a sudden? I'll be the first to admit that there's a level of competency being displayed that's a little shocking too. It's like, you know, there's that meme about, you know, it's CIA the last 20 years and they're like, where 9/11 man at? And then it's like, you know, CIA in 2022. And they're like, yeah, we know what Russia's military is going to do 3 days before they do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And like, how did this happen? And I think there's going to be a great story and an interesting story there. You know, a counterintelligence story and an intelligence story and a whole series of things that happened behind the scenes that haven't been written about yet.
Do you think both Western intelligence and then Putin himself sort of overestimated Russia's capabilities for the, you know, initial cockamamie invasion plan because of Syria? But I mean, do you think because they were pretty effective in Syria when they weren't, I mean, Russia hadn't really operated beyond its borders like that and wasn't supposed to be able to either for that matter. And that kind of, I remember there's a lot of sort of rage or some, you know, out of DC and out of NATO that they did it and that they did it effectively, reasonably effectively, I think, right, in Syria. They helped, you know, save Assad's regime. And then maybe that led to people overestimating their capabilities. Do you think that's possible?
I mean, I think that you have to go back and look at 70 years of Russia analysis. And, you know, not to be overly accusatory, but I mean, we have to take like a sober look at how we perceive and how we have judged Russian capabilities for 70 years. You know, like I interviewed Milt one time and he was saying, he was like, the cable traffic I sent back, this was during the 80s when he was running the program in Afghanistan, the covert action program from Pakistan into Afghanistan. And he's like, the cables I sent back to Langley that I got the most pushback from were assessments about the Russian army in Afghanistan. And he was like, you should have seen the venom that they came out with attacking me. Because I was saying, like, yeah, the Russian military isn't performing well. Like, they're not really what you think they are. And I remember interviewing a Russian military analyst pretty early on in the war in Ukraine, like maybe actually that first month. And she was like, this isn't the Russian military I've been studying for the last 5 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't mean to be overly critical of her or anyone else, but I mean, the reality is actually, yes, this is the Russian military that we've been looking at for 70 years. Mm. And the reality is we got it wrong. That we overestimated their capabilities, and maybe some of the more sober analysts out there understood, like, hey, they got one aircraft carrier, it catches on fire wherever it goes. Like, is this really a global power? Are they really able to project force across the world? And rather than, you know, flying sorties and dumping barrel bombs on civilian populations in Aleppo is totally different than running complex modern air operations the way the U.S. Air Force does.
The initial invasion was, I seem to remember, you know, watching you on Twitter as well, just being sort of
like, what?
Shocked, like you got, but it really was that sort of appalling from everything you could gather. Right?
I mean, me and my friends were all scratching our heads, like, why have they not gained air superiority?
Right.
Like, what are they waiting for? Like, what's going on here? That should have been like day one.
Yeah.
It was all very like, what? Like, I'm talking to people on the ground that the like haphazard, you know, way that they were assaulting forward, and they'd send a few guys one day to attack and then a few guys the next day. And it's like, where's the Russian like human wave that we hear about in Stalingrad and like, you know, they're going to wheel up artillery like they did in Chechnya and just level Grozny. Like, when is that going to happen? And I mean, I don't mean to sell short the amount of carnage that has taken place in Ukraine, but yeah, this isn't the Russia that many of us, including myself, thought it was.
I mean, we did after the full scale invasion in February of last year. You know, we did a series on the Chechen wars, looking back. Like, this invasion made a lot more sense again after that, because in a lot of levels, the brutality, the incompetence.
Chechnya was small enough that essentially the Russian armed forces could, you know, pull back and try again. Lessons learned and stuff.
Right.
You really can't do that against Ukraine.
But they made very similar mistakes over and over and over, like appalling mistakes. But yeah, it was small enough they could do it.
I mean, it may be kind of pedantic or maybe naive of me even to say, but I can't help when if you watch that that television show Chernobyl, and you know, as you're watching that, and it's kind of telling the story about the meltdown. And you see that, like, there were good people in the Soviet system, but they were fundamentally locked into a system that just didn't work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to say one other thing about your note here. You also had the last part of your note about publishing. Ultimately, I felt I was being asked to compromise my work and put careers ahead of my own integrity. That's why the piece appears here. And that's just great. I mean, that's inspiring, and it should be inspiring for other aspiring reporters. I mean, you should do that. And it's, I was going to say, you know, in a sense, you might have also dodged a career bullet from my experience here, because what could have also happened is that, I mean, some of my experience, like, I wound up getting a scoop with a guy, right, with Yasha Levine early in 2009, that this, at the time, small Tea Party thing was backed by these mysterious oil oligarchs called the Koch brothers. And my scoop got destroyed, right? Because I didn't have editors that backed me when the heat got turned on. And that fucked me out of a great scoop. And your piece might've got published. So I did it for Playboy and for a whole bunch of reasons. Then they took it down. Then everyone said, oh, you're the guy that had that taken down. It was a real pain in the ass. Yeah. And then it wasn't really till Jane Mayer's big piece in The New Yorker came out that it was, but by then it was ruined. And it also like really messed with my head and introduced me to the, to just how many different ways you can get screwed in this business. So you might've dodged a bullet by having full control over it, because if you published it in a major publication and then they very quickly caved, and they do sometimes, especially with something important like this. They cave. Then they retract it. They find any goddamn little reason possible, some word, something, and they retract it. They don't back you. And then you're known as the guy, anytime you do anything else controversial after that, as the guy who had a piece retracted by X publication.
Yep, yep.
So it was smart to pull it out.
I honestly didn't really think about that. The fact-checking and the integrity and all of those things are really paramount, but there is a component of this job, like you got to have some balls. Right.
Yes. Yeah.
Like people are going to come after you.
Yes.
And, you know, you have to be confident in your story and what you do.
Yeah. And you have to really believe your editor and make sure your editor believes in you.
Yep. Yeah.
It all depends on the editor in that sense.
I'll tell you right now, a great, great editor in this field is Sharon Weinberger, who I worked with at Yahoo News. She works at the Wall Street Journal now. I wish I was still working with her. She's really terrific.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I mean, Paul Carr, who we had at NSFW Corp.
Yeah, he was great.
He stood by us on every, and we did a lot of controversial stuff and stood by us all the way with that is really important. Yeah. But anyways, I want to post all this stuff, links to everything here. And I just, again, want to congratulate you on a great article. I mean,
one
other thing I wanted to say, more journalism stuff, but I know that one of the other sort of objections to your story by some blue checks or some people who don't want to, I don't know, accept it was, oh, but the key sources were anonymous officials. And look, Seymour Hersh's probably his biggest scoop ever in the 70s was about the illegal CIA program spying on Americans. And that's what sparked the Church Committee hearings and the Pike Committee hearings and the Rockefeller Commission. And that was all based on an anonymous source. It might've been Colby for all we know, but it was some people very high up in the CIA, but it was anonymous, right? So it's not that anonymous sources are always there, you know, people need to like not be stupid about that. It's about trusting that the sources staying anonymous are. This is all just about credibility and trust, really, right? From the journalists and the editors.
There's certainly an aspect of that. I feel like the second you ask people to trust you, you're probably not all that trustworthy.
Trust but verify, or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah. I would ask, you know, read what I wrote seriously and think about that and keep that in mind as we go forward. And, you know, I think, you know, 24 months from now, the New York Times will publish a story that slowly inches towards this truth and pretend like they came up with it all on their own.
Yep, you'll never be mentioned.
We'll mention you.
No, of course not. Of course not. I'm trash and, you know, fuck that guy. But, you know, the thing with anonymous sources is, you know, if the Department of Justice would like to stop prosecuting sources, then they can be on the record. But so you can take it up with them if you got a problem with it. You know, when you're reporting on covert action programs in real time, it is what it is. Like sources are going to be anonymous in that case.
A lot of times, you know, bad actors use that anonymity to plant bullshit stories. And that's why.
Well,
that's what strikes
me. Like for these people to suddenly develop an allergy to anonymous sources is bizarre.
Yeah. It's because it's not their anonymous sources.
Exactly.
It's funny to see some of those reactions from people.
I'd like to push it out as much as we can, but have you had a hard time getting other, like, again, we saw the Economist guy reacting to it and you know, giving it some respect. Have you had a hard time getting it out to other, I don't know how many, you know, people you're friends with in the sort of blue check media world, but
Very few. I mean, I know journalists, like I know most of the journalists who cover the same kind of stuff I do, you know? So like, yeah, I know Seth Harp, I know Sean Naylor, I know, you know, these are good guys. Right. But I'm not like really networked with the journalism community overall, right?
It's a good thing. All right. Well, we'll let you go. We kept you for a long time. This has been a great discussion. And once again, really congratulations on that piece and look forward to reading more of your journalism and your books. And so we'll post links to all that.
Yeah. I appreciate it, guys. There's, you know, much more to follow. So thanks for reading.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Okay. That was our talk with Jack Murphy. Great talk, by the way. Really enjoyed it. Great article, and we're going to post links to it. And I have a feeling that that even as we were talking, I think that that other piece that he just put out about the police raids and all that stuff. Yeah, Fort Bragg. I think it already came out, so we'll be able to post that as well. Anyway, I think we could wrap it up. The article and the discussion speaks for itself.
Let the interview stand on its own because it was fantastic.
That was great. Thanks again, everyone. Thanks to Jack, and talk to you again soon, John.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye.